Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the state of democracy in India. Today's episode is part of a special series on the President's Inbox about the future of democracy. I have been sitting down with experts in recent weeks to discuss whether and where democratic governance is faltering around the world. This special series on the state of democracy is part of the Council's Diamonstein-Spielvogel project on the future of democracy. With me to discuss the health of democracy in India is Pratap Bhanu Mehta. Pratap is a leading scholar of political theory, constitutional law, international affairs, and society and politics in India. He has written widely and edited widely on these subjects, including as a contributing editor for the Indian Express and as an editorial board member of major journals such as the Journal of Democracy. Until earlier this month, Pratap was a professor at Ashoka University, where he had previously been vice chancellor. Pratap, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Pratap, I will note that last year, India celebrated its 73rd anniversary of its independence. If the United States is the world's longest continuously operating democracy, India holds the title as the world's most populous democracy. If I have my numbers right, something on the order of 900 million Indians are eligible to vote. And during the last national elections back in 2019, more than 600 million Indians did exactly that. Just to put that number in perspective, that's more than four times the number of people who voted in the U.S. presidential election last November. But just as there are signs of trouble in American democracy, there are signs that all is not well with India's democracy. I'll note that earlier this month, Freedom House issued a report that downgraded India from free to partly free. How would you assess the state of India's democracy, Pratap?
Look, there's no question that I think Indian democracy is undergoing one of the most significant challenges that it has faced since its inception. I mean, I think the only equivalent period that one can think of was the period between 1975 and 1977, where India officially declared an emergency.
This is when Indira Gandhi was...
Yeah, that's right. That's right. When Indira Gandhi was...
Prime Minister.
And formally, of course, India is not in a state of emergency, and there are significant differences between that period. But I think on five basic dimensions of democratic health, I think there is a widespread consensus that Indian democracy is under great stress. The first, I would argue, is what in India we call majoritarianism, which is enshrining the principle in law, in politics, in society, that the Hindu majority of India, India is a Hindu nation, has in a sense a somewhat privileged constitutional space, presence as it were. And it's being enshrined in the law in different ways. So for example, just to take a very recent example, you know, for your listeners, many Indian states have passed a law that requires registration with the state and in some cases state approval for interreligious marriages. Many states are, for example, banning cow slaughter. So there's a whole range of laws and practices associated with enshrining the dominance of the Hindu majority that are now being openly practiced. Prime Minister Narendra Modi himself laid the foundation stone of this new temple at a disputed site in Ayodhya. And one of the most remarkable things he said in his speech when he was laying this sort of foundation stone was that he described that day as perhaps even more significant than India's independence in August 15, 1947. He said, this is the day that India finally comes free of the tutelage of 1,000 years of slavery, not just, you know, 200 years under British colonialism. And everybody in India understands that that's a kind of signal that in some senses, Muslims are not as much sort of part of Indian civilization and culture as the Hindu majority. So I think that's the most important principle, the India's turning into a majoritarian ethnocracy. I think the second measure is the erosion of civil liberties, which is something that was captured in, I think, the VDEM index that came out of Sweden, you know, which is an index most political scientists, I think, respect. I think Freedom House around the world, there's a little bit more ambivalence about it because of its kind of closer connections to the US government, but certainly VDEM. And what do we mean by civil liberties? Now, To be fair, India is always, like the United States in some respects, has had laws in the books that allows the state sometimes to curtail civil liberties. So, for example, in the US, if you think of post-9/11 laws and Guantanamo, we've had Prevention of Terrorism Acts. We've had the law of sedition on the book. Previous governments have occasionally used them, you know, to clamp down on civil dissent and protest. But this government is now increasingly using these laws in very overtly political context. So, for example, students protesting have been booked under a law called UAPA, which is sort of, you know, it's a prevention of terrorism law. So if you protest, you'll be classified as a terrorist. Indian courts have been very reluctant, the Supreme Court in particular, to grant speedy hearings or bail in habeas corpus cases. And as you know, habeas corpus is the cornerstone of any civil liberties constitution oriented towards civil liberties. So in a whole range of things, this instances, this government is using instruments to send a signal that you cannot take your civil liberties for granted, and you cannot take it for granted that courts will protect the civil liberties at the appropriate time.
Pratap, can I just ask you a question on that? Why is it, in your judgment, that the Indian courts have not been willing to step up to protect civil liberties? Is there something particular about the Indian judicial system? Is it because the judicial system somehow is subservient to the current prime minister? How do we understand that aspect of it?
No, that's a very good question. And actually, that's the third dimension I was coming to, which is that, you know, any democracy is based on a system of checks and balances, right? And certainly the separation of executive power and judicial power is one of the kind of cornerstones of modern constitutionalism. And by the way, the Indian Supreme Court had the reputation of being one of the most powerful courts in the world. In fact, it sort of, you know, pioneered forms of judicial remedy that most other courts would actually think twice about. And so in that context, your question is even more pertinent. I think there are two things going on. I mean, this is something I think we're still trying to puzzle over, because one of the other features of the Indian Supreme Court is that it's formally very powerful and independent. So, for example, the Indian Supreme Court has the predominant voice in appointing judges to the higher judiciary. In that sense, judges do not require executive or legislative ratification.
Very different than the United States.
It's a very different, very powerful institution. I think there are two things going on there. I think one, I hate to say this, but I think there is evidence based on what judges say and the nature of judgments that are coming out, that you probably do have more judges now in the judiciary that are drifting towards the ideology of the BJP.
This is the governing party.
The governing party.
Indian Nationalist Party.
So what in India we call committed judiciary, in some senses, that I think their ideological leanings are getting the better of their judicial and constitutional judgment. I think the second thing I think to bear in mind, and having studied the Indian judiciary at least for a while, is that, you know, judiciaries are strange institutions. I mean, at one level, look, they have no power other than the power of public credibility, right, in some ways. And the Indian judiciary has been interesting in the sense that when it sees that political power is drifting in a particular direction, and as powerfully as it has, I mean, one of the things I think people have to remember about Mr. Modi's government is that it is extremely popular politically. It's a powerful election machine. It is exercising power in unprecedented ways, that even a lot of judges who might otherwise not be ideological fellow travelers are quite careful about taking on government. Now, whether that's due to fear, whether that's due to deference to what they think is the popular legitimacy of the government, I think is an open question. But I think both of these things are at play at this moment.
Okay, so you were walking me through five dimensions.
Yes, so this was the third, which is actually the erosion of checks and balances. And you know, India, actually, one of the remarkable things about Indian democracy is that it had innovated a lot in creating lots of independent institutions. So, for example, the Election Commission of India. That's an institution the United States could learn from, for example, which is a, you know, an independent statutory electoral commission that depoliticized, you know, very significant issues like the gerrymandering of constituencies. One of the reasons election turnouts in India is actually still relatively high is because the Election Commission has cleaned up the electoral rolls. There's, you know, non-partisan voter registration. So the Election Commission was a magnificent success in those respects. And I think, you know, they've helped preserve the integrity of electoral democracy. But you are finding that at the margins, even an independent institution like that is at the margins, for example, scheduling elections in ways that are more to the convenience of the kind of campaign strategies of the ruling party. The Reserve Bank of India, another very powerful institution, very independent institution, has by and large done the government's bidding. For example, India did this experiment of demonetization, which is withdrawing all the cash in circulation, ostensibly in the theory that we could weed out illegal money.
Quite an undertaking, by the way.
It was an extraordinary undertaking. I mean, it's the human dimensions of it, the political mobilization around it. So the general erosion of checks and balances, I think, has weakened. So that was, in a sense, the third dimension. The fourth dimension, which again, in comparison to the United States, is interesting, is, so India is a very large country and has had a system of federal checks and balances. You know, our constitution allocates power to the central government, to different states and provinces, and sometimes even to the third tier of government, local government. One of the remarkable things that has, I think, happened over the last 4 or 5 years is that the constitutional allocation of powers, which used to demarcate, you know, the states, for example, will look after law and order, the states will look after agriculture, that allocation of powers is being quite radically altered under this government. And there are two particularly egregious examples of this. One just happened as recently, actually as this week. The state of Delhi, which is kind of like Washington, D.C., but it did have an elective legislature, that is now being downgraded because the party in power is a party that is different from the party at center. And so this elected assembly will, for example, not be able to take decisions that do not have the approval of a lieutenant governor appointed by the central government.
Sounds like you're getting a little bit of what we would call here in the United States the imposition of home rule.
Exactly. That's a good analogy. I mean, Jammu and Kashmir in 2019, it was one of the few instances we have seen since independence where a constituted state, its status as a state was taken away and it was downgraded to a territory that is governed by the central government. So I think federalism is, I think, the fourth dimension. And the fifth dimension, which is, I think, harder to articulate in institutional terms, but I think you will get a sense of this. So, you know, one of the things that was discussed a lot in the United States is the role of media in the democracy. And there was a sense that a lot of the polarization that is being produced in society is being produced by structures of media ownership. Fox News. Now, the United States had one Fox News and maybe a couple of countervailing channels, CNN and stuff. Imagine a polity where you have 15, 20 channels that are Fox News on steroids, that are actually, many of them are not making money, but they are still being funded by capital, you know, Indian capital, to, in some senses, control and unleash a barrage of propaganda, you know, in terms of the information order. Print media in India is still relatively, I think, more diverse, particularly the English-speaking print media. But if you look at the print media in the regional languages, in vernacular languages, there is a concerted effort by the government to, in some senses, ally with Indian capital to make sure that this information order is quite tightly controlled. Even on social media, for example, I mean, there's a lot of evidence coming out for, you know, that the head of Facebook India had to resign because it became very palpable that Facebook was being partisan in some ways to the ruling establishment. So there's a palpable sense of an attempt to control the information order, you know, through formal and informal means. And if you think of the free information order as being central to democracy, Indian democracy is certainly weakening. So I think these are the five principal dimensions I can think of. But, you know, there are lots of nuances to the story. Maybe we can discuss.
Just on that last point, Pratap, I should note that there have been a number of reports in the U.S. media of the efforts by the Indian government to imprison or jail journalists who write stories that the government disapproves of. I know there's one case in which a leader of, I think, an online news service was accused of spreading panic for reporting correctly that the state's Hindu fundamentalist chief minister had visited a religious event in violation of a national lockdown. Right. So the supposed crime wasn't reporting fake news, it was reporting the truth. It's just the truth did not redound to the favor of the governing party. Have there been a lot of cases of journalists being sidelined?
No, so there are cases. And as always, I think in these instances, the real story is not sort of what happens on the surface. I think the government can legitimately maybe reply and say, look, statistically, the number of cases of this kind is not very large. You know, there's probably a, you know, dozen, couple of dozen across the country. There are specificities to some of those cases. The real story, actually, if particularly if you look at the vernacular media, is the formal and informal pressures that government puts to bear on media channels not to hire particular kinds of journalists. So there's actually a very significant number of journalists who had the reputation of being relatively independent, relatively more professional. The government will make sure that any media house that actually hires them will be formally or informally penalized. I mean, there are lots of instruments of the state you can use, you know, tax raids, tax inquiries, those kinds of things. So I think, to be fair, I think, you know, and this government does always say that, look, we are not in a state of emergency. We are not mass arresting people.
So it's not 1975.
And it's certainly not 1975. But in some senses, it's actually a cleverer and more insidious strategy, because by targeting particular individuals at particular moments who can't defend themselves, you actually send a signal to everybody. Right. And it's a clever strategy, because formally you can say, yes, there are no mass arrests. This is not said 1975. There's no overt clampdown. But you are quietly and effectively sending a message to a lot of journalists that there will be consequences if they report on certain kinds of stories.
So I just say this story is also personal for you. I mentioned at the top that you were a professor at Ashoka University until earlier this month. Now you resigned, citing discussion with, as I take it, university officials that made it, let me quote you here, abundantly clear to me that my association with the university may be considered a political liability. Your defenders have gone even further to suggest that the university's ruling board was concerned about your criticisms of Prime Minister Modi. And I will note that a number of people have come to your defense here. And I think that there was not just student boycotts, but nearly 200 leading thinkers from around the world signed a letter defending your academic freedom. So you have sort of felt some of this insidious pressure from the ruling government.
Yes, I mean, and you know, to be honest, I will say this, that frankly, I'm actually one of the privileged ones. I mean, I think in the larger context, I mean, if you're in a public university in India, you'll often be under even more direct pressure. We have colleagues, one of modern India's most interesting social scientists, somebody called Anand Tentumbe, who actually worked on Dalits. I mean, Dalits are, you know, historically oppressed castes in India. One of the leading voices analyzing and thinking about the Dalit condition in India. It's as we speak, he's been in prison for 2 years on charges that I think most people who've looked at the evidence are blatantly trumped up. But more interestingly, I mean, one of the things that makes people suspicious of that case is the fact that typically Indian courts at least used to grant bail to such defendants. He's not even been granted bail. There's Sudha Bhardwaj, a absolutely first-rate human rights lawyer, returned from Harvard to work in India amongst marginalized communities. Again, 2 years in jail. Honestly, my case is a little sort of flash in the pan. It's, you know, the trustees express certain views. I said, okay, fine. If you think I'm a political liability, I'm in a sense happy to leave. I think the reason the case caught attention, because the university I was at, is a new and relatively prestigious project. And I think the sense that if even these kinds of private universities seem to be not immune from these larger political considerations, then it's going to be hard, even harder for colleagues, I think, in less, you know, privileged and protected universities. So yes, I mean, I think, you know, academic freedom is certainly imperiled in various ways.
So could you sort of lay out for us, Pratap, why you think India has taken this illiberal term, if I can use that phrase? And I'll note that you wrote recently that India's elites have been intermittently impatient with this democracy, its noise, its energy, its messiness, its deference to constitutional form. It seemed to stand in the way of the economic utopia that might be unleashed if only democracy could get out of the way.
Frankly, we are still trying to understand, I think, you know, what brought about this transformation. Because, I mean, I have to say, look, you know, if you look at it from the outside, India is still a very contentious place. Electoral democracy is still very high and powerful. I mean, I think even on the VDEM index, on the electoral criteria, India scores high. And we still haven't had a situation where somebody has actually contested an election. We are not quite there yet.
Right, understood.
It might happen soon. You can tell the story, I think, on two dimensions. I mean, obviously, it's a very complicated story, but I think there's two things I would put forth. So one, I think it's less a story of the successful rise of the BJP. It's more a story of, in a sense, the collapse of its rivals in the Congress order, particularly, I think, after the 2009 financial crisis. I mean, many of your listeners might recall from 1999 to 2008, 2009, India was coasting along very well, 8% growth rate, the highest we had achieved in a decade. I mean, there was a sense of immense optimism about the country that it's kind of liberal democracy, 8% growth rate.
Our model works.
Somehow, you know, the country is kind of finally beginning to arrive. I think with the onset of the 2009 financial crisis, whose effects were not immediately evident, but I think in hindsight have become clear, I think two things happened. One, that financial crisis exposed the vulnerabilities of India's growth model, that India's growth model had been tied to global growth. And as global growth collapsed, there were pressures on the Indian growth story. So there was a genuine sense of sort of economic pessimism and paralysis that began to set in. But the second thing that I think happened was that the old Congress establishment, you know, which otherwise has been India's dominant ruling party since independence, it was exposed as both plutocratic and corrupt on the one hand, and elitist and out of touch on the other. And particularly Mr. Modi's first election, which he won in 2014, was largely run on these two themes, against plutocracy and against government paralysis. That, you know, what you needed was a strong leader, a strong party that would take tough decisions, and the promise of a relatively clean government, I mean, which has been severely, I think, disappointing. So I think a large part of the story is actually the collapse of the opposition in some ways. And even subsequently, that collapse and decline continues. I mean, even as we speak, Congress Party still has not decided who its leader is going to be. It has still not restored intra-party elections. So I think that's, I think, one element. I think the second element that I think Mr. Modi did tap into is there was something to the charge that he made that the old ruling establishment was, at least in its cultural articulation, sort of more elitist and out of touch. And his personal biography is, of course, very compelling, rising from humble circumstances, a certain kind of charisma and touch with vernacular politics that people began to see in him a much more closer embodiment of who they were culturally. And Mr. Modi, like populists around the world, has made it a trope that, you know, one thing I'm going to target is these elite formations, you know, that have had a stranglehold on Indian power. So that populist identification with him is actually extraordinarily strong. And I have to say, I mean, even if you're a critic of Mr. Modi, purely from a political point of view, you have to admire the extraordinary way in which he politically managed to project that. So I think that's one part of the story. I think the second part of the story is a much longer term story, which is, it is, I think, important to remember that the BJP, the ruling dispensation, Mr. Modi's party, is not just centered on his persona. I mean, what they have is a big social movement behind them, namely in the form of an organization called RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which has been now around for 90 years, actually 97 years, I think. And that organization does a lot of the work of cultural transformation, you know, the creation of new collective identities, the transformation of Hinduism into a kind of organized conglomerate, much more than the kind of pluralistic and open-ended inheritance that it had. And they've been doing this work very effectively. And the advantage they have is they're not concerned about the next election. What they are concerned about is large-scale cultural transformation.
Transformation how?
So they have a couple of sort of focus points. One, their core belief is that India should be a Hindu nation and political power should be an expression of Hindu identity. Their diagnosis is that one of the reasons that that has not been possible in India is because India has always had too many cross-cutting cleavages. You know, it's a society divided by language, region, different castes. And often other political parties have kind of counted on these divisions to create different kinds of electoral coalitions. So for example, in the 1960s, it used to be said that the Congress is a coalition of Dalits and Muslims, you know, that that's a predominant social base. And I think what the RSS has been effectively and quietly doing is, particularly I think on the caste side, is saying that, look, these divisions do not have to define our political identities, that there is much to be gained in some senses by consolidating various factions and constituents of this Hindu identity, and even of those some outside this fold, into the single majoritarian identity. So there's a lot of cultural work that goes into it, instilling fear about of minorities, for example, very quietly and subtly. Sometimes, to be honest, and the RSS has been very good at this, tapping into constituencies that were not served very well by the Congress Party. And, you know, this is the kind of cultural work. I mean, imagine the analog in the United States would be, you know, the evangelicals, the Tea Party, all of those civil society organizations, you know, bringing people to a point where these ideas seem much more inevitable and natural. I think it's that social movement that, you know, has now proved to be extraordinarily successful, partly because of its organizational capacities, partly because there's no counter to it. I mean, I think the problem with the center and the left in India is, let me put it in very colloquial terms, we are extraordinarily lazy. We do not have grassroots organizations, partly because I think we were part of the ruling establishment in some ways. We just assume that there are these state channels we have to, you know, exercise influence. Whereas, you know, the RSS and the BJP are there. I mean, you have to just look at every election, the number of their volunteers that show up, the cadres they have created. So there is a large scale, I think, social movement, and I have to acknowledge that fact, that it's not just the doing of one person at the top.
So I'm curious, sort of, you know, as I listen to you, I have to admit that India is fundamentally different in many ways from the United States. But obviously, a lot of what you're talking about has echoes in American politics. Certainly, you know, disillusionment with the inability of government to deliver, concern that the government has been dominated by elites that are sort of self-interested. Obviously, you know, Donald Trump ran on the idea of draining the swamp, which sort of tied into that. And clearly, his argument was that the policies pursued by the elites helped the elites and didn't help average people. So in some sense, I get the sense that there are similarities, at least in terms of when we sort of talk about the rise of populist leaders and why they can take root and how they can be sustained. Is that a fair reading?
Yes. No, I mean, I think there are similarities. I mean, in some ways, I mean, I think another similarity. So for example, you know, one of the strands in American politics that was talked about during the Trump era was whether there was a underlying undercurrent of concern about the loss of white dominance, the racial trope in some ways, right? In some senses, I think, you know, the Hindu majoritarian trope is a kind of analog of that, that, you know, there is a core cultural identity to this nation that has, you know, to be cast in these ethnic terms. So I think that similarity is there. I think the differences, I think, I mean, if we look, and they are also products of the same historical moment. I mean, in a sense, the post-2009.
Right. The same globalization forces and the rest.
Ironically came at the heels of a very successful centrist administration. I mean, you know, the Congress Party for a while did produce 8% growth. It looked like it could hold the country together, just like Obama was this, you know, ray of hope in the United States. And now there's as much anger against that centrism as anything.
Yep.
I think the differences, however, as I said, I think one, I actually do think Mr. Modi has a much wider, deeper social and organizational base than Mr. Trump did. I frankly also think he's, in a political sense, I think much more competent. I mean, he's quite careful. In fact, if you look at his speeches, what he says as prime minister, you know, on a lot of issues, you will not find the kind of outrageousness that, you know, Trump did on climate change, on vaccine denial, on, you know, all kinds of things. I mean, you know, so at the surface level, I think it's much more sophisticated. He has a much more...
And Prime Minister Modi is not tweeting at 3 a.m. in the morning.
No, he's not. And his tweets are politically well judged. I mean, I think, you know, he has an extraordinary knack of kind of communication. As I said, he has a much deeper, I think, social movement behind him. I think the second difference, I think, is that, you know, in the United States, political competition did not collapse with the rise of Trump. I mean, the Democratic Party still remained very powerful. And, you know, in a sense, it's genuine political polarization. The voters are split, you know, whatever, 70 million or to 80 million. In India, I think the biggest sort of surprise and shock, and talking of checks and balances, was the almost complete collapse of the opposition in terms of the number of seats in parliament. So the Congress, in a house of 542 in the lower house, was reduced to 43 seats. you know, and we often wonder, even if the Congress had 120, let alone, you know, 40, I think you would have seen a little bit more check and balance. So what that does, I think, to civil society, to independent institutions, is that they don't see any political channels for articulating their grievances because the opposition has kind of collapsed politically. That, I think, is one significant difference, that the Congress party is not like the Democratic Party was in the United States.
Is there any sign that can change? So, you know, the theories of politics, that a party collapses and then the people who were served can recombine because their interests are being harmed. Any sign that in opposition to Prime Minister Modi and the BJP is forming, or does it remain in disarray?
It is in disarray. So there is some pushback. I think the pushback usually comes in the form of particularly local level election results. I mean, we have three significant states going to elections in the next couple of months, and it's likely that the BJP might lose a couple of those, particularly Tamil Nadu, where there's a strong regional party. But the Congress party, I'm afraid, is showing no signs of a revival. In fact, if anything, its decline is being accelerated. There's a variety of reasons. Partly, there's an inner structural contradiction in the Congress, which is it's still very much dominated and feels it needs the family, Rahul Gandhi and Sonia Gandhi, as the kind of glue that holds the party together. But, you know, there's no ideology now that, in a sense, binds the Congress. I think over the years, its organization has been so hollowed out that it almost has to start from scratch. It's struggling for political funding, frankly. And unfortunately, the collective leadership in the Congress, you know, let's put it this way, there's a conflict between the interests of the incumbents who don't want radical change in the party so that they can preserve their position in the party. But that status quo is bad for the party as a whole. And I don't think the Congress has been able to, in a sense, come out of that contradiction.
I want to ask you one final question, if I may, Pratap. And that has to do with the role of other democracies. Do they, in fact, have a role in trying to reverse this sort of democratic backsliding, this term to a liberalism that we're seeing in India? And I raise it, of course, in the context Joe Biden being elected and president. He's talking about rejuvenating American democracy at home and sort of trying to reinvigorate democracies abroad. That's a sort of big agenda. It sort of fits into the American self-conception of its sort of founding role in creating democratic government. But there's also the reality that most countries, like most people, don't like it when other people tell them what to do. So to what extent should American foreign policy be concerned about this turn in India? And is there anything it can do about it?
I must confess, I am actually skeptical about the ability of foreign powers to change the course of this. I think we have one stark example, for example, in the EU itself. I mean, let's not forget Hungary and Poland are members of the EU, and the backsliding in Hungary is pretty similar to what, you know, we are seeing here. I think with the United States, one, to be honest, abroad, there is a lot of skepticism about the US's commitment to democracy promotion because it's always been seen as selective.
And it has been.
Why pick on India if, you know, Saudi Arabia or even China, I mean, historically has kind of escaped scrutiny. Now, of course, there's a changing consensus on China. And so it's always seen as an instrument of geopolitical power. It's not seen as a genuine commitment to democracy. And to be honest, I think it's very hard to argue against that case. Second, I think I'm skeptical of the Biden administration's, I think, ability to do anything, because on the scale of things, you now have a big geopolitical challenge in the name of China. And I suspect the definition of democracy will be defined in relation to China. It'll not be defined in relation to the health of our own constitutional democracies, right? So, you know, if you want to build a kind of coalition against China, will you overlook faults that I think, you know, are the case? Third is, I think, for the reasons that you mentioned, which is I actually think that interventions by the US government, actually even lobbying by Indian community abroad to get the US government to intervene, actually pretty much backfires. I think there's almost inevitably a nationalist backlash, and it's often not sensitive to context. So I think in all those ways, I'm actually skeptical. And finally, I mean, just as a little footnote, I think the crucial determinant of Indo-US ties is going to be the business relationship, to be very honest. And I think business will go, if there's money to be made, they will turn a blind eye. So I don't think you're going to get a big push, you know, towards that. The only thing that I think does make a difference at the margins, I think, is not any direct action or activity. It is that, you know, when there is a norm in the global context, right, that part of what gets you respected and recognized as a great power, if you want to join an elite club, is if you walk in with the pride that, you know, you're coming from a country that has a robust tradition of strong institutions and democracy. It certainly, I suspect, weighs in the minds of leaders, you know, when they go to G20, G9, G10, or whatever club that they're going to create. And I think one of the things that Mr. Trump's rise to power did is that it gave a complete carte blanche to pretty much everyone. You know, we couldn't care less what you do. Insofar as that global norm is changing, maybe it is the case that at the margins, leaders are becoming a little bit self-conscious, you know, about their global reputations in a way that might not have been. But other than that, I actually don't think the United States is going to be able to get out of this conundrum that any intervention will be seen as a geopolitical act, not a commitment to values.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. Again, my guest has been Pratap Bhanu Mitha, a leading authority on Indian politics and society. Pratap, thank you very much for joining me. Great conversation.
Thank you very much.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherrill. As always, Zoe did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you very much, Zoe. Special thanks also go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.